you, Joanne. Welcome to a special broadcast from KALW. I am Rose Aguilar.
And I'm Malihi Razazan.
And we're broadcasting live from the 13th San Francisco Green Festival, the country's largest and longest-running sustainability and green living event. There are more than 300 exhibitors here, many great speakers covering a lot of topics, focusing on sustainable agriculture and healthy living. And the festival is taking place right now at the Fort Mason Center. We're at 2 Marina Boulevard. Please do not drive here. There is no parking. Do not drive. There's no parking. You can catch a shuttle to the festivities at the Civic Center BART station, and you can check KALW.org for more information. For the next 2 hours, Malihi and I will be talking with activists and entrepreneurs about a number of topics: the sustainability of our food system, food labeling, GMOs, fair trade clothing, and electronic waste.
And we have got a fantastic group of guests lined up to talk to us today, including Ted Smith, who has spent decades drawing attention to the thousands of toxic chemicals in our electronic products that are harming our communities and the environment. Hope Bohanek will raise questions about whether livestock production can ever really be humane or sustainable. And Stephen Drucker will stop by to talk about one of the first lawsuits pushing for labeling genetically modified food and, in general, the legality of GMO products. These are just a few of the speakers at the Green Festival this weekend. If you come, you will also find family activities, cooking demos, and a wide selection of green products among the other festivities. You can visit KALW this weekend at booth 634, located on the major floor in the first aisle, all the way left of the entrance. Be sure to stop by and say hello. We have volunteers stationed at the booth all weekend. And if you would like to get our newsletter, please do leave us your email and contact information. You can find out more about us and the festival at KALW.org. We are here with 2 hours of live coverage. The Green Festival runs today until 6 p.m. and from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. tomorrow. One-day admission is $15, $5 for students, seniors, and veterans, those under 18, bicyclists, members of the Sierra Club, Global Exchange, or Green America. Get in for free.
Yes, and again, do not drive. There is no parking. You can catch a shuttle for the festivities at the Civic Center BART station.
Or carpool.
Yeah. Well, don't even do that. There's absolutely no parking. And joining us to kick off the show today is Diana Donlan. She's director of the Center for Food Safety's Cool Foods campaign. The campaign aims to empower the public to make critical connections between our food and its impact on the environment. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Rose.
Hi, Diana.
How are you?
Great to have you.
So, thanks so much.
You focus on a piece of the system that doesn't get much attention. We hear so much, obviously, about climate, so much more attention now about food choices. But you focus on soil, and you say that we really need to spend more time on soil and dirt.
Yes. Here's my quick elevator pitch. We know that with our climate crisis, too much CO2 is overwhelming our atmosphere, and what the atmosphere cannot absorb is dissolving into our oceans and causing acidification and harming marine life. Meanwhile, 50 to 70% of soil carbon globally in the soil has been lost. So it's really an opportunity for us to take that CO2 out of the atmosphere and the oceans, where it's causing climate change and all sorts of other problems, and put it in the ground, where it does a world of good. And it has ancillary benefits in addition to helping with the climate change.
So this is a big question, but the soil, obviously, the health of the soil differs whether, you know, you're looking at an organic farm, whether you're looking at a massive factory farm. What would you say right now is the state of the soil? Are we in trouble, or what does it look like right now?
We are in trouble. And as I mentioned, we've lost on a global scale so much soil carbon, but we can put it back through composting, through regenerative agriculture, and organic certainly falls under that. Because what the soil needs is it needs us to observe something called the law of return and put our waste, what we consider waste, our food scraps, back in, because of course in nature there is no waste, and that is food for soil organisms. And we're only just beginning to really learn about the complexity of the soil, and it's very exciting.
When you look at U.S. industrial agriculture, where our cash crops like corn, soy, wheat, pretty soon, they're all genetically modified. So they're using a lot of fertilizers and chemicals, right? So how does that impact the quality of soil, not just in the short term, but in the long term, in terms of reversing this pattern and absorption of carbon dioxide?
Yes, that's very important, because in this country, in the United States, corn, soy, and cotton, over 90% of it is genetically modified, and it occupies about 50% of farmland across the United States. Now, that has a lot of implications. We may not see that here in California because we grow such a variety of fruits and vegetables, over 400 different types of fruits and vegetables. But in much of the country, we have these vast monocultures, and these chemicals that you mentioned do compromise soil health. They make it more difficult for the microorganisms to live in the soil, and they also make it more difficult for the soil to have structure and hold carbon in place. And absorb water, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on where we're moving? Because the USDA recently approved genetically modified potatoes. We did a show about the GMO labeling laws that went down in Colorado and Oregon recently, and I was shocked to learn that zucchini and squash now are becoming GMO. So, I mean, you do a lot of really great work in terms of trying to educate people about what we're eating. How can people keep up with this, and what does it say about the fact that we're moving so fast when you look at what actually is genetically modified right now?
Right. So, on balance, mostly the genetically modified are the commodity crops, because those are what we plant in abundance, and those are the ones that are a huge market opportunity for the biotech companies. But we do see a move into genetically modifying all sorts of things under the guise of helping with the climate or helping to feed the world. Mm. But really, those are just pesticide-promoting technologies for the most part, and offer the consumer very little benefit.
So when you look at the environmental movement and climate change movement, for example, anti-climate change movement, why doesn't the quality of soil and its structure not getting as much attention as other parts of this movement?
Well, to date, the climate movement has been very technology-focused and very emissions-focused, and what we're trying to do is say that those are important pieces, but we need to look further. We need to look at nature's regenerative powers. Nature wants to be our ally, doesn't want to be our adversary necessarily. We just have to foster the conditions where we can work with nature. And as I said, the soil piece offers us so much hope, because there is such a vast opportunity, more than we can even imagine, to put carbon back in. It's just through photosynthesis. As you know, plants inhale CO2, and then they expire the oxygen, and they take that carbon and put it down through their roots into a form that the roots then trade with other microorganisms. And when you have perennial agriculture, the roots can be very, very long, and the carbon can go way down into the earth and become very stable.
Oh, interesting. Because you have this Center for Food Safety. You're involved in Cool Foods campaign, which also focuses on improving soil health. So can you talk about what people can do? Today it's very hard to really just focus on local level solutions, because this has become such a global issue, and it takes a global village, per se, to really mitigate the climate change. So can you give us what you think the solutions are to tackling this important issue?
Well, one thing that I think holds great promise is to have a composting movement across the United States. I mean, San Francisco is the leader on this. 80% of our organic waste is being diverted, but we're really in a class of our own. There are some other cities that are doing composting, but not at this scale. And there are plenty of cities, big cities, that have absolutely no composting requirements on the books. So much of the action in the climate movement has been happening at the level of cities and then percolating up to the state level, and then eventually the federal government will follow. So if you're already eating locally and in season and buying organic food and avoiding industrial meat products and poultry products and trying to seek out foods that are grown in a regenerative fashion, you can take the next step and perhaps get involved, make sure that your town, your county is composting.
I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan at the Green Festival, and we're joined by Diana Donlin, director of the Center for Food Safety's Cool Foods campaign. Diana is giving a talk today, Cool Foods and Cool Planet, combating climate change through sustainable food, at the Green Festival's Good Food Stage at 12:30. And Diana, why is composting so important? And talk to the people who live in places where it's actually not available.
Sure. So I think composting in most people's mind is a form of recycling. And you know, we talk a lot about food waste and the travesty of food waste, and we do waste as much as 40% of the food that is grown in this country. And that has huge climate implications. It wastes, you know, not only soil capital, but water and human labor and our hard-earned dollars. We go to all this work to grow the food. You would think that we would at least eat it, but we don't. And what happens to that food? It goes, most of it, to the landfill. And when it goes to the landfill, it comes back to haunt us as methane gas, because in a landfill, food does not decompose and turn into something that is available for the microorganisms.
Why is that? Because I'm sure a lot of people assume that it does decompose.
It's because of the lack of oxygen in a landfill. So it's compressed so tightly that it's anaerobic. It just doesn't cycle the way it should.
And also it is possible that it reacts with other chemicals in the landfill as well.
Well, and I'm kind of picturing the landfill, and because we live in such a throwaway society, I mean, we now have just massive products that we throw away that we never used to, because in the old days we would fix things. We wouldn't just go to the discount store and buy a new iron, a new table, a new fridge, I mean, what have you. I mean, this stuff is so cheap now. And so is that part of the problem? Is you're mixing the food with all of these major products that are made with unsustainable, like wood and plastics, and is that what's happening?
I'm sure it is. Those other items, those other consumer items that you mentioned, are actually a smaller part of the waste stream. I think because food is, in this country, relatively inexpensive, we tend to take it for granted, and we waste, as I said, this tremendous amount. In the developing world, people that buy the food don't waste the food as much. The losses there occur post-harvest and trying to get the product to market. So those are infrastructure-related losses, whereas in the so-called developed world, it's at the consumer level. We go into a restaurant and we expect to have a vast array of choices on the menu, and the restaurant has to have all those things available. Well, that in turn generates a lot of food waste.
You know, on that point, what do you think it would take to change the way we think about food and waste? Because we have these massive stores like the Costco's where you can buy things in bulk, and there's no possible way that even a family of six, for example, could eat all of this stuff. But as you said, it's so cheap, and so it's easy just to throw it away.
Well, the Cool Foods campaign has a set of principles that's on our website that you can follow. And by thinking about these things, which include seasonality, you know, rotating foods in and out of season, eating things when they're available makes it more affordable to buy organic, for instance. I mean, right now we have an abundance of squashes because they're in season. So that makes sense that the prices would be lower and that's what you should be buying. that if you're eating in season, you're more in tune with the earth and in natural rhythms. We get so disconnected from the natural world by going into these large big box stores.
With this campaign, how are you reaching out to people to really change behaviors? Because at the end of the day, it seems like change has to come from local level, and then it percolates up to state and federal government, hopefully, and globally. So what are practical steps that you're taking in order to bring these people into this campaign?
Well, we're very focused on bringing more women into the climate movement. Mothers in particular in the United States spend over $200 billion at the grocery store every year. So that's a tremendous amount of power that women have to affect change through their everyday food choices. And if you're lucky enough to eat three times a day over the course of a year, and let alone a lifetime, that's a lot of impact. We're also producing a lot of our materials in Spanish because we feel that that's an underserved audience in the climate movement. So we get our blogs translated into Spanish. We have a little video on...
Yes, it is in Spanish.
What's been the effect of that so far? What kind of reaction have you received?
We work with a group called Moms Rising, and they've given us a lot of positive feedback. And they said, this is so great. You know, please do more. And our budget allowing, we will do more. But in terms of the larger campaign, at Center for Food Safety, we do a lot of legal work and a lot of policy work, and we're working with our legal team. We file lawsuits against different government agencies, trying to get them to do their job. We were involved early on in the U.S. versus Massachusetts, the big case, the landmark case that got carbon dioxide to be regulated as a greenhouse gas.
So you're doing a lot of work, but as you speak, and you talk about soil and compost, something that, you know, even some, I am pretty conscious about what I eat, how much I eat, but at the same time, it's very difficult, you know, to make it tangible that you have to compost, because I always think if I eat healthy, if I eat good food and vegetables and if I even throw them away, you know, they're not going to end up in a landfill, a huge landfill, and it's going to work against me and the future of this planet. So I'm just trying to see how we can make this part of the environmental movement conversation, you know, because it has so many different components. And as you said, greenhouse gases is sort of a macro, you know, structural change that we think, but it doesn't trickle down to all these important elements in it.
I'll give you an example. I have a very dear friend who lives in Denver, and I stayed with her this summer. I was giving a talk on this soil carbon opportunity, and I practiced it while I was staying at her house. And she lives in a pretty arid place, and she started composting as a result of my talk. Well, now she's just completely evangelical, and she calls me up and says, you know, we had this big rainstorm, and I looked out at my neighbors, and everything was washing away, but because I'm composting my garden, the water was infiltrating, it was percolating, I can see my plants growing. So you can start at home if you have a terrace, if you have access to a garden. The important thing is to keep the ground covered, because nature does, it's like skin, you know, nature, wherever there's nature, she'll rush in and plant ivy or grasses or something to keep the land covered. If it's not covered, then the soil microorganisms die, and the soil actually blows away with the weatherization.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to start composting. You changed one mind.
Do you have composting in Oakland?
Yes, actually, it's very interesting. I wanted to say that a few years ago, City of Oakland, I can't remember if it was for free, but it was subsidized. But for a very small amount of money, I think, if I'm correct, that they provided us with composting. It was a huge box that all we had to do is really assemble it and start composting. But it's been sitting in my garage.
Now,
so I'm going to take it out.
It's so easy.
Yes.
And
I'm
once you get into the rhythm, it's a part of your daily life.
Yeah. That's great.
We're all good. Thank you so much for joining us, Diana. I know you have to run to your talk. Diana Donlin is director of the Center for Food Safety's Cool Foods campaign, and she'll be speaking at 12:30 in just a couple minutes at the Green Festival's Good Food Stage. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for your great work.
Thank you.
Longtime fan.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thank you. And actually, we should do a show, Rose, on soil.
On composting and soil.
And soil, yeah. I think it's really important.
Well, remember we did a show, I don't know, a couple years ago about dirt. There's a great documentary called Dirt. And it just made us realize that we don't really talk about dirt. This is something we kind of take for granted. In fact, I bet a lot of people don't even get their hands dirty anymore.
That's true.
With
and
dirt,
you know,
unless you're lucky enough to have a garden in your backyard.
I am looking at your website, the Center for Food Safety, and you have really a great literature about composting and about soil. So we'll do that.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan, and we are here at the San Francisco Green Festival. It is at the Fort Mason Center this year. It moved. It runs today until 6 o'clock and tomorrow 10 until 6. Admission is $15 or $5 for students, seniors, and vets. If you've got a bike, and I really encourage you to bring your bike because there's no parking. If you're under 18, if you're a member of the Sierra Club, Global Exchange, or Green America, you will get in for free. And joining us next,
Hope Bohanek, that's a beautiful name, has been an animal protection and environmental activist for more than 20 years and recently published the book, The Ultimate Betrayal, Is There Happy Meat? She is a nationally recognized leader and a speaker in the animal protection movement and is currently serving as projects manager for United Poultry Concerns. She is also the primary organizer for the annual Conscious Eating Conference at UC Berkeley and the Sonoma County Veg Fest. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I read part of your book. It's really an amazing and interesting book because you have a different take on meat industry, and both in terms of environment and the politics of the meat industry also.
And I should say, you also have a very different perspective on the most effective things we can all do when it comes to climate change, right? I mean, we're hearing about soil, we're hearing about composting, which is very important. What's your take?
So, absolutely. I didn't catch some of what you said.
Oh.
So,
no, I was just saying that your book is really delves into what meat industry does, how much it contributes to global warming and climate change, and also you have spoken with a lot of people that have been impacted.
Sure. So
I know Rose asked you a question, but I also, if you can follow up by talking about really giving of an overview of this huge industry.
Sure. So it's interesting because I've been vegan myself for 25 years, and so I've been talking about this issue for all that time, for decades, to people having conversations about the impact, both environmentally and on the animals, of this industry that has been growing and really affecting billions of lives, both humans and animals' lives. And it's interesting because the conversation has been kind of the same, but in the last maybe 3 to 5 years and more now, there seems to be a shift happening. And people are saying things like, oh, well, I buy free-range eggs, and I buy organic meat. And, you know, they almost feel like the conversation has ended and the animals are happy, everything's okay now. So I felt that this was a really interesting issue to delve into more. So I did extensive research for the book, numerous interviews, and found out some very interesting things. And one is, you know, that there is actually so little regulation on these labels. It's really sad and pathetic how little regulation there is on the labels. It's really, on most of them, free-range, cage-free, these kinds of labels, it's the farmer's basically just his word. They fill out a form, send it into the regulatory agency, whether it's the FDA, usually the USDA, and they're awarded these labels. No inspection of the farm. No, you know, there, no one gets denied for these labels. It's pretty much anyone can get them. So there's a wide range of different farming practices under this, you know, these umbrella labels. But what I found is, on an ethical level, you know, there's inherent cruelties in this industry that just cannot be washed away with a label. There are things like, you know, mutilations and debeaking.
stocking and dehorning and castration and all these things that are done without painkillers that are still prevalent in all these humane labels. There's separation of families with the dairy industry, with the egg and chicken industry. No chick is hatched in a warm nest with a loving mother. No. You know, they're hatched in these industrial hatcheries. And of course they go to slaughter at a very young age. So there's inherent cruelties that just can't be washed away.
Is the slaughtering process any different between a conventional factory farm and a so-called organic factory farm?
Okay. Well, no. No. Unfortunately, no. The majority of these animals that are under these labels, with whether it be organic or humane or cage-free, they're all, 99% of them are going to the same slaughterhouse as any other commercial animal. And these, of course, are brutal, brutal places. Slitting the throat of an animal, this is not a quick or painless way to die. These animals suffer horribly during the slaughtering process. Very, very sad. There are some new methods that are arising, like mobile slaughter units, which are basically a trailer. It's like a slaughterhouse on wheels. It's a trailer that comes out to the small farm to process animals, slaughter animals. I don't like using that euphemism of processing. They are killing the animals. This is for cows, pigs, chickens, larger animals, for these MSUs, these mobile slaughter units. There is one good thing, and that is that the transportation is taken out of the equation. Of course, the transportation for the animals can be brutal. No food or water, no weather protection for sometimes up to 3 days. A lot of animals die in the transportation process. They just know that several animals are going to die. It's an industry-accepted loss instead of giving them some small comforts in the transportation. But anyway, so the MSUs take the transportation out of the equation. But it's the same slaughter as in the slaughterhouse.
Is it regulated by FDA or USDA?
The USDA, yes.
USDA?
Yes, they do still have to inspect these MSUs. And because they have a lot of pest issues, rat problems, mm-hmm. because they're right on the farm, they use chemicals and pesticides and all kinds of chemicals in these MSUs that they don't use nearly as much in a slaughterhouse. So there's that added issue.
Because you remember what happened in Petaluma earlier this year.
Oh, absolutely.
You know that they had to do this meat recall because they
massive
brought it massive.
Recall.
This was 8.7 million pounds.
That's right.
Of meat.
That's right. So,
and
yeah,
it basically
they're
was both for organic, pasture raised and
that's right.
Conventional.
That was a very small slaughterhouse called Rancho Veal. Been there for years, and they did process all the local animals, local, humane, all those labeled animals. And the USDA is quote unquote inspecting, but it's such a revolving door. It's such an industry where they just kind of pat each other's backs, and so unfortunately a lot of times things are overlooked and even what they're looking for is so lax, the laws are so lax, so unfortunately these animals suffer terribly. There was the huge meat recall, and that was all locally labeled, humanely labeled meat.
I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan at the Green Festival, and we're joined by Hope Bohanek. She is author of The Ultimate Betrayal, Is There Happy Meat? She's also projects manager for United Poultry Concerns. All right, so speaking of happy meat, in the Bay Area, new restaurants are popping up constantly. Full disclosure, I've been a vegan for almost as long as you, and so I always look at all the menus of the new restaurants. I can't find anything to eat in hardly any of these places. But a lot of them serve what they call sustainably raised meat. They've got pigs on the menu. A lot of people want to do the right thing, and they go to these restaurants, or they go to Whole Foods. And Whole Foods actually has a label that says, I don't remember, it's been going around on Facebook, something like sustainably raised happy meat. So people want to do the right thing here. What would you say to those people?
Well, I'd say that I'm grateful that they care, and that's one of the beautiful things is that everybody loves animals. Nobody wants to see animals suffer, and this is a very positive thing. And I think that I'm grateful that people are moving in that direction, that they care, they're seeking out alternatives. But unfortunately, people need to realize that no matter when we're commodifying animals, when we are trying to make a profit off their bodies or their dairy or their eggs. There are these inherent cruelties that we cannot get around. For instance, organic, free-range, cage-free eggs. People are always asking me, "Oh, what's an ethical egg to find? You know, which brand is ethical?" Well, the thing is that no farm, no matter the size, no matter what label they have, they can't profitably hatch their own chicks. So the chicks are all hatched in industrial hatcheries, and these are brutal, horrible places. These hatcheries where they come into the world in these metal drawers, and the workers are roughly tossing them around, and there's, you know, conveyor belts and metal machinery. And I've interviewed workers that have worked in these places, former workers, that have seen the baby chicks just ripped up. I mean, I don't want to get too graphic. It's very, very, you know, brutal and sad what can happen to these baby chicks. And of course, in the egg industry, half of them are male, and of course the males don't give eggs. They're also not profitable to be raised for meat. They don't get big enough fast enough to be raised for meat. So all those baby males are, they're a byproduct of the industry. They're trashed. They're disposed of. They are killed right as they're born. We're talking billions of baby chicks that are just thrown away in the backs of the hatcheries, that are suffocating on their brothers, dying of exposure and dehydration. It is brutal. And this is for any label. I mean, even the humane label, the cage-free, the free-range, it's still embedded in that industry.
When you say all these things, I wonder how big is sort of a sustainable, environmentally good meat. How big is this industry? Because when we think about meat industry for example, in the butcher shop in Berkeley or Oakland, you see that it's locally, these are local animals and they are very, as you said, humanly treated and all that. So is this a huge industry by itself? Because I know, for example, in California, when we were doing a show about the slaughterhouse in Petaluma, I realized that sort of this market, this organic meat market, is really controlled by one or two major suppliers. Is that true?
Well, yeah, and actually now the industry is seeing the advantage of this newly emerging market. I mean, it's a very small percentage right now, all this alternative, labeled food, very small, but it is growing, and the industry sees that, and they're getting into it. And it's interesting because many people will think, people are doing this because they care about the animals. When I was doing the research, it was very interesting that, farmers would have a chicken shed full of the battery caged, conventional, terrible raised, where it's very, very cruel raised chickens. And then right next to that would be a cage free operation, which is still, they're out of the cages, but that's not the only misery of their life. They're still indoors and, debeaked and all of this. However, it was just interesting that it's on the same farm.
Wow.
If they really cared about the animals, wouldn't they have them all out of the cages? If it was really better for them, wouldn't they have them all out of the cages? No, it's because they know that there's a market for it, and there's a consumer out there that will pay more for those eggs.
Mm. So it's side by side on the
Absolutely.
Same farm.
Yeah.
How common is this?
Very common. Very common. Mm. Absolutely very common. And another interesting tidbit up in Petaluma, Judy's Eggs, which is touted as being one of the best organic and local and, cage-free, all of that. Judy's Eggs actually was sued by the Animal Legal Defense Fund for false advertising because they say, our chickens are out in the sunshine and out in the grass. Well, I have been to Judy's Eggs farm. I have seen the location, and you do not see a chicken. There's no chicken in sight. There's just these windowless buildings, where they are just packed in there by the thousands. They never see the light of day. They never see the grass or feel earth under their feet, and they go to slaughter at a very young age. So, we cannot commodify animals' bodies and have it be humane. It just can't be done.
So I was thinking, what happens if tomorrow this industry is regulated, all of it, and you do buy a pack of meat that says it is sustainable beef? Mm-hmm. Or it's organic. What does that label really tell us, even if it is regulated and labeled correctly?
Well, it's hard to say because, if it's labeled cage-free, well, yeah, literally, they're out of the cages. But that doesn't that doesn't, it's not the only horror of their existence. So it's going to, that's going to really differ label to label. But you mentioned sustainable beef or grass-fed beef. Well, it was really interesting when I was researching for my book. You know, I thought, well, for sure, these labels, at least it's going to be a little better environmentally, right? Mm. In some cases, it was not. Grass-fed beef can actually cause 50 to 60% more greenhouse gas emissions. And those cows use more water.
Why?
Well, numerous reasons. One is that it takes them much longer to get up to market weight and to be slaughtered. Commercial cows are only alive about maybe 11 months, whereas a grass-fed cow has to be alive 24 to 27 months. So they're longer, more life excluding the methane. As well, interestingly, you know, they have the four stomachs, the rumination, and the chewing of the cud. This causes methane naturally. They're burping the methane. When they get on their natural diet, when you're feeding them grains, that actually gets suppressed. When you start feeding them grass, they produce more methane because that's their natural diet. Very interesting. You know, and so here people are buying this grass-fed beef thinking they're doing something better for the environment when actually it's worse.
I read that something else is happening, which is as a result of the drought in California, is that now there's going to be a three-tier meat system. For example, one is grass-fed, one is grass and hay, and one is hay and corn. And corn is genetically modified. So they basically are bringing other components of global warming into what that sort of sustained beef mean. And I know, for example, one butcher shop that I went to in Berkeley, it tells you that it will be, they will be having labels, and then the price will be based on how these cows are raised.
Yeah, interesting. But also, just really quickly, you know, I don't want to demonize beef alone, because a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I don't eat red meat. Well, all meat, chicken meat, eggs, this is still causing really terrible environmental degradation, air pollution, water use, water pollution, you know, really plant-based diet. That's where you're going to have the biggest impact on reducing your eco footprint.
Hope Bahanek is author of The Ultimate Betrayal, Is There Happy Meat? We're here at the Green Festival. While the Green Festival has never served meat in its food court, and in fact, on the website, it actually says a plant-based diet is best for the environment, there are a lot of environmental organizations here that say, make sure the meat you eat, if you're going to eat it, is sustainable. And the documentary Cowspiracy focused on this. Rainforest Action Network is one of the few major environmental organizations that are advocating for a plant-based or no-meat diet. Center for Biological Diversity sometimes does. It's really interesting. What are your thoughts on that aspect of
this? I'm glad you mentioned Cowspiracy, because that's a great film. I really encourage people to seek it out. A wonderful film on the environmental impact of animal agriculture. And you know, I think the environmental community is coming around more and more. I've always been so grateful to the Green Fest for being a leader in that and stepping up and being vegetarian and vegan. So that's really great. The Center for Biological Diversity, they actually just recently had a new campaign that I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's something about eating for wildlife, or reducing your impact on wildlife and biodiversity by eating a plant-based diet.
Right.
I mean, there's so many aspects to this. You know, loss of biodiversity, loss of species, it's all connected to animal agriculture. And I think the environmental community is coming around. They're hearing the message, they're getting it more and more, and we're going to see more coming out from them on, you know, encouraging a plant-based diet.
And, you know, I always wonder why this issue is so controversial. Why is it so difficult to really talk about this issue openly?
Yeah, I think that there's numerous levels. I think that people have kind of a primal thing around their food. It's almost like, you know, when a dog and you take the food away and they they want to bite your hand. I think it's similar. I mean, people are very, I think they're kind of on a primal level scared to change their diet. And they need to make make sure that it's going to be convenient. They need to make sure that it's going to be healthy. And luckily, that is all changing with the vegan diet. It's getting more prevalent, easier to find the food. We're learning that you live healthier, a longer life, reduction of chronic degenerative diseases. So I think that, you know, the more it normalizes, the more people understand that it's a healthy, easy thing to do, it'll make it easier. I think people are scared to change, but you know, we understand that we've got to make some drastic changes to heal this planet. You know, right now our planetary house is on fire. You know, it is on fire. And all these little, you know, organic meat and free-range eggs, that's like throwing maybe some buckets on the fire. What we need is a fire hose, and that fire hose is veganism, a plant-based diet. We really need to put this fire out.
Thank you so much, Hope.
Hope Bahanek is author of The Ultimate Betrayal, Is There Happy Meat? She's serving as projects manager for United Poultry Concerns. If you'd like more information about Hope and her work, she's got a booth here at the Fort Mason's building here at the Green Festival. Hope, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan. And we are at the Green Festival. It has moved this year to the Fort Mason Center. It opens tonight until 6, tomorrow from 10 to 6. Do not drive. There is absolutely no parking. If you ride your bike, it's free. Take a shuttle from Civic Center, downtown San Francisco. And if you want more information, go to kalw.org. And our next guest is Stephen Drucker. Stephen is a public interest attorney who initiated a lawsuit against the Food and Drug Administration for declaring genetically engineered foods safe despite their own scientific researchers' warnings. Stephen is a frequent commentator on GE Foods. He served on food safety panels at conferences held by the FDA, and his book is called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth: How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. Stephen, thank you so much for stopping by.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. We've done a lot of shows about GMOs. We just did a show about the labeling laws that went down in Colorado and Oregon. Malihe and I did a ton of research for this show. Never once did the word illegal come up. So tell us, I mean, your argument is that genetically modified foods are actually illegal.
They're on the United States market in stark, blatant violation of the food safety laws of the United States of America. And it's a shame that people haven't heard yet that they're illegal, because I've been bringing this message out for quite a while, but the U.S. media will not cover it. I'm very glad that KALW is actually going out to let me speak live. Because when things are pre-recorded, it gets basically censored out.
Really?
Well,
really?
There's a huge, huge pressure against letting the public know the facts about genetically engineered food.
And what you say is that FDA's own scientists declared that it is not safe and it should not be consumed, but there has been some sort of a cover-up. Can you explain exactly the relationship between the scientists, FDA, and illegality of the...
Actually, the scientists didn't say exactly what you said, but the import is the same. The FDA established a biotechnology task force in the early 90s because they knew they had to come out with some kind of formal policy statement on genetically engineered foods. Now, starting with the Ronald Reagan administration, the federal executive agencies had all been told to start promoting the U.S. biotech industry. That continued through the first Bush presidency. So the first Bush was president when this was happening. And so the FDA on the one hand, and the FDA admits that they have a formal agenda to promote biotechnology. That's an admission. They're also supposed to uphold the law and science. Unfortunately, they've done a far better job at promoting than upholding the law and science. So they did establish a task force. They had scientists from all the major divisions on that task force, microbiology, the Center for Veterinary Medicine, because it was known that a lot of the genetically engineered food would be fed to animals to a very high percentage. Toxicology division was involved, all of the major ones. And they were submitting memos to the biotechnology coordinator and the supervisor, the higher-ups saw these two, that when they examined what genetic engineering is and the potential risks, they said, you can't assume these foods are going to be just as safe as conventional their conventional counterparts. The genetic engineering, contrary to the claims of its promoters, is not essentially a natural, simple extension of natural breeding. It's very different, and the risks are different. And they gave many reasons why they are, also scientifically sound reasons. Unfortunately, the FDA administrators weren't interested in scientifically sound reasons. They wanted an answer that these foods are essentially the same. They didn't get it from their scientists, so they covered up what their scientists said and lied.
You know, when we had Professor Sheldon Krimsky on our show from Tufts University, he was talking about how it takes a long time, like it did in tobacco and lead, to really understand and how safe or not safe this is scientifically, to prove it. However, he said, meanwhile, since there are some evidence collected by other scientists, especially in the European Union, in European countries, he basically says we have to be skeptics and we have to have a moratorium, and that's where the labeling comes from at the minimum. What do you think about that argument?
Well, it's stronger than that. First, it's so important for people to know that in the United States, we have the strictest food safety laws in the world. You know, Hope, who spoke before me, was saying that the laws are lax when it comes to the labels on meat and doing some things with meat. When it comes to new food additives, the law is actually very strong, and it has been since 1958 when Congress passed the Food Additive Amendment. Any food such as these new genetically engineered foods have to be proven safe before they're marketed, and they have to be proven safe, reasonable certainty of no harm through standard scientific procedures. Now, the FDA has reversed the burden of proof, essentially. First, they have... Let me get back first to their scientists.
Please.
Because their scientists, the consensus among their own scientists was so overwhelming that one of the FDA officials, a compliance officer, who, as her title implies, her job was to make sure the FDA stays in compliance with its own laws and procedures. She wrote to the biotech coordinator in early January of 1992, and this is, by the way, on the website of the Alliance for Biointegrity as Memo 1, saying that the FDA was trying to push a square peg into a round hole by trying to force an ultimate conclusion that there's no difference between genetic engineering and traditional breeding. She said genetic engineering is different, and according to the technical experts in the agency, it leads to different risks. Unequivocal. But what happened was, and a sampling of many of these memos from the FDA scientists is also on the website of the Alliance for Biointegrity. I'm the executive director of that nonprofit organization. And biointegrity.org for anybody who wants to check up on them. Biointegrity.org. And what did the FDA do? It suppressed all the memos. And when it announced a few months later, it announced its policy. It stated that it was not aware of any information showing that these foods differ in any uniform or meaningful way from other foods. That's a blatant lie. Its files are filled with information, and anybody can go to our website and read that information. And then it stated that these foods wouldn't have to be tested at all. They were presumed generally recognized as safe when it knew that even within its own scientific staff, they were not recognized as safe. And I found a memorandum, Memo 8, on our website from the FDA biotechnology coordinator to a Canadian health official admitting that they weren't recognized as safe generally within the scientific community as a whole, that there was not a consensus. But the FDA claimed there was, so they're on the market illegally.
Stephen Drucker is a public interest attorney who initiated a lawsuit against the FDA for declaring genetically engineered foods safe despite their own scientific researchers' warnings. I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan. We're doing a special broadcast at the Green Festival. So, Stephen, let's talk about where we are today. Because according to the USDA's own numbers, 89% of all corn, 94% of soybeans are genetically modified. 75% of processed foods are genetically modified. So if you go to a traditional grocery store and you shop in the middle of the store, you are almost guaranteed to be buying genetically modified foods.
Correct.
Right? So Professor Sheldon Krimsky on our show last week said he was only able to find 11 studies overseas, and they were all conducted on mice for the most part, and they did find health effects. You mentioned potential effects. You just mentioned risks. What are they? Because I'd say probably all of us right now are eating genetically modified, right?
Yes, unless it's very difficult to avoid it in the U.S. You
right.
have to look for the non-GMO verified label because there are a lot of games played with labeling, too. Anytime people are eating soy or corn or canola oil that doesn't say certified organic, they can almost be sure that a significant amount of it has been genetically
engineered.
And canola
oil isn't almost everything.
Because it's supposed to be a health food. But
okay.
most of it is genetically engineered, which makes it a non-health food.
And now potato.
Exactly.
And very soon wheat.
So what are the potential risks?
Well, as the FDA scientist said, and as the expert panel of the Royal Society of Canada stated in a 2001 report that hardly anybody in the U.S. has been told about either, there can be new toxins formed that are toxins that are unusual, that would not ordinarily be in that species at all, that have never been in the species, and would be very difficult to find with the kinds of tests that are being done. You can't really find them through the superficial chemical analysis. What would be needed would be, for those kinds of risks, long-term toxicological feeding studies using the whole food, and it should be multi-generational. Well, there are hardly any studies like that at all. In fact, I don't know if there are any conducted by industry.
And is that because the studies take so much money to conduct and
so
there's
much
just no money,
so much time, and why do it if none of the regulators are forcing you
right,
to do it?
Right.
Not even in Europe. They're very lax in Europe as well. The USDA is the worst. They don't require anything. Somebody could dump genetically engineered foods on our market, and they don't even have to tell the FDA, according to the FDA.
But, you know, last week, like a couple of weeks ago, USDA approved GMO potatoes. And all the articles that we read noted that because potatoes naturally produce certain carcinogenic when they're cooked at high temperatures, so GMO food is healthier to consume, French fries, even at high temperature. This is what they said. But there is another research there is another research, that's the interesting part, by a prominent Scottish biologist who fed GMO potatoes to rats and found out that rats develop precancerous cell growth, smaller brains, liver, testicle, and partially atrophied. I mean, on and on and on and on.
And that study was published in The Lancet, one of the most peer-reviewed scientific journals in the world. However, the other side has trashed that out so badly, most people don't even think it was a published study. The poor researcher who headed that up at a prestigious, the Rowett Institute in the UK, was fired for doing his job, for doing a good study. He suffered a heart attack with all the stress he went through. They sullied his reputation. He was one of the most respected food safety researchers in the world, but that's what happens when people do studies that come out showing problems with genetically engineered food. But that study has never been refuted and never been properly replicated, and it stands as a warning. But even if the important point that I need to come back to is, even if there were no studies showing problems, and there are several published in good peer-reviewed journals, what is needed from the other side are studies proving that these foods are safe. And they haven't produced that evidence. And by law, that evidence is required for every genetically engineered food. And there's not a single genetically engineered food for which substantial proof of safety exists today. They're all on the U.S. market illegally. And I can't overemphasize that point. I also, you said where we are today. Where we are today is, fortunately, the U.S. population is waking up to the fact that they actually are eating genetically engineered foods and have been for over 15 years. But now the main focus has been on the right to know.
Right.
We need to label. There's a much more basic right, which is actually much more solidly grounded in statute. That's the basic right not to be exposed to inadequately tested genetically engineered foods in the first place. That's the right that I emphasize. We have a right not to be exposed to these foods. So more people need to wake up to the fact that the proper response to foods that are illegally on the market is not to label them. You take them off the market. Every one of these foods should be banned. They should have never come to the market in the first place. And asking for labeling and putting all of our attention on labeling allows them, it gives the implication that they're legally on the market, which they are not.
Well, and at a time when the EU, the European Union, is very close to approving a plan to allow EU nations to ban genetically modified crops on their soil, even if they're given approval to be grown in the EU, we can't even get statewide labeling laws. So, for example, in Colorado and Oregon, those crops were defeated. Multinational food and biotech companies spent $37 million, $17 million in Colorado, $20 million in Oregon. In 2012, here in California, the law failed 53% to 47%. I'm sorry, the measure. And the multinational and biotech companies spent $45 million to defeat a labeling measure. So how do you process all of this when we can't even get a labeling law in a state? And yet in the EU, they're about to ban crops from being even grown, modified crops.
Well, the important thing to still note is, yes, we're having a lot of difficulty getting labeling laws passed, but in 1958, the law was passed for food safety that should have kept these foods off the market in the first place. So the whole point is to ban them. We don't need new laws. We need to enforce the laws that are being broken. We need more public awareness and pressure just for the FDA to uphold its own laws. It's been breaking its laws since 1992.
But here we are today, 89% of all corn, 94% of soybeans. I mean, they've been able to do this in three decades?
Because the law has been broken instead of followed. If it had been followed, none of this would have happened. And it's all based on systematic misrepresentation. The book that I've written that you mentioned at the beginning,
Altered Genes, Twisted Truth.
If people go to the website, alteredgenestwistedtruth.com, they can get a link to seeing it on Amazon, descriptions of it. If they go to the Alliance for Biointegrity's website, biointegrity.org, they can see the memos, many of the key memos from the FDA scientists. So you don't have to take my word for the fact the FDA has been lying to you. My book is going to be released in January, and Jane Goodall has written the foreword, in which she states it's without doubt one of the most important books of the last 50 years. And many scientists have been on the review team and have praised the book. A professor at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies has stated it's incisive, insightful, and truly outstanding, that it's a must-read and a pleasure to read.
Earlier on the show, you said that media won't talk to you, or if a pre-taped conversation happens, it never reaches the air.
Not the mainstream media.
Mainstream media. UC Berkeley professor Ignacio Chapella was recently quoted as saying that there is a de facto ban on scientists, quote, asking certain questions and finding results. He says, quote, it's very hard for us to publish in this field. People are scared.
That's correct, and that's why we need more knowledge. That's why the industry will be very scared of my book, because it basically shows up the fact that the scientific community as well, the scientific establishment, has been part of the fraud. They have been the National Academy of Science, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. My book shows in detail how they've been putting out misrepresentative statements for many years. I know that sounds like a crazy theory, but it's not. I have my law degree from UC Berkeley, my undergrad from UC Berkeley. I was an honor student at both levels. I know what I'm talking about. I'm very careful with the research. Anybody who reads the book and sees the voluminous endnotes, they'll see how well documented it is. The truth hurts sometimes, but the truth has to be told.
Where is this information that the FDA put out there declaring that genetically engineered foods are actually not safe? Where is that information?
No, excuse me. You said
I'm sorry. The FDA, you're suing the FDA for declaring GE foods safe despite their scientific research warnings. Where are those warnings? That's what I meant.
I said 24 of the key documents are posted on the website for the Alliance for Biointegrity, biointegrity.org.
Okay.
They're cited voluminously in the book that I wrote and in many of the articles I've written, some of which are freely available on the biointegrity.org website as well. But for people who really want the full story, my book gives the fullest story yet. And
Since we have a couple of minutes left, since you have been following this issue for more than two decades, with all the bills that have been introduced, with all these initiatives, even the fact that they have failed, even though it passed in Maui, do you think the space for debate on GMO has expanded greatly, and it is you at this point and in near future can be part of this conversation of it's not only it's about labeling, but it's also about the fact that these food products should not be consumed by people.
Yes, well, your point is good. Without all the labeling campaigns, people's awareness wouldn't have been raised to the level where they're even halfway open to what I'm saying. So, yes, it's been very valuable. My book praises the labeling campaigns for raising awareness. But the point I was making is it's very important now to realize, after all this money, this effort, and we still haven't got the laws, that what we really need is a ban. And we already have the law for that. We just need to enforce the law. And it's very important. So I think it's time, and many of the state leaders in labeling campaigns who've read the information, one of whom has been a reviewer of my book, has said, you're right, we really need to up the game now. We have to focus on raising awareness and enforcing the law and banning these foods.
Before we let you go, what advice would you give to citizens who are greatly concerned about this? And there's also a class element in this, because if you don't live near a farmer's market or a corner store that offers fresh fruits and vegetables, the only option you have are GMO foods.
Well, maybe not the only, but you've got to be very careful. If you don't have to buy organic, if you're careful and buy foods that don't have soy, corn, canola, cottonseed oil, derivatives from those, beet sugar, those are the main ones, or Hawaiian papaya. So there are ways of avoiding that, but it's difficult in the U.S., and it's a challenge. So people have to really be motivated to do it. And I agree, it's very difficult.
Right, because 75% of what's in the grocery stores are GMO foods.
When I travel, I have trouble eating because people often don't even know what their ingredients are at restaurants. And it's very difficult.
Right.
It's difficult to be GMO-free. That's why we really need to be more like Europe, where they're not on the market anyway. That's
and also
the way
something
to be safe.
Else we don't talk about is that GMO seeds, they have really transformed native agricultures around the world with, you know, examples such as India.
Correct.
I think that's also a major issue that should be figured into this conversation.
It's a major, major problem. That's why it's gone so far. There's been so much cross-pollination and genetic pollution. That's why we really need to ban it sooner rather than later, because the damage has already been done to a large extent.
Stephen, we'd love to have you on your call when your book comes out in January.
I would love to come back.
Stephen Drucker is a public interest attorney who initiated a lawsuit against the FDA for declaring genetically engineered foods safe despite their own scientific researchers' warnings. His book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, will be coming out in January. The subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. Stephen, thank you so much for stopping by. And you will be giving a talk at the Green Festival tomorrow, main stage, 2 o'clock, Why Genetically Engineered Foods Are Unacceptably Risky and Unequivocally Illegal.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your courage in having me on.
Thank you so much.
And I look forward to coming back.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you
Pleasure
so much.
To meet you.
And you are listening to KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco. I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihei Razazan at the Green Festival. It is in its new building now, Fort Mason to Marina Boulevard. Do not drive. There's no parking. You can get a shuttle from the Civic Center BART. You can take a bus. You can ride your bike. But be sure, do not drive. We'll be here for the next hour. The Green Fest is open until 6 o'clock, and then tomorrow from noon to 6.
And aside from everything else here today, Rose, the Green Festival also features music. The Caution is a rock and roll band of 13 to 15-year-olds performing today on Sunday at 4:30 at the Eco Superhero Family Fun Zone. I wonder what they look like. They are currently playing covers with their own added unique, sassy, stylistic vocal and on songs by the Foo Fighters and Red Hot Chili Peppers. These kids are a group of talented musicians who are great students, role models, and share a passion for the environment. Here is the Caution covering the Black Keys' Gold on the Ceiling. We'll be right back.
Liz Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan at the Green Festival. We're here at the Fort Mason Center. It's a new space in San Francisco near the Marina Green. And we'll be here for another hour talking about fair trade, once again talking about food. And then we'll also be talking about the Electronic Take Back Coalition. We'll talk about environmental justice and labor rights in the global electronics industry.
And now we are joined by Scott Leonard. He's CEO and co-founder of Indigenous Designs Corporation, an organic apparel brand and producer of handcrafted fair trade clothing. Scott oversees organizational and financial planning for the company, but is also responsible for directing the Indigenous brand identity. Scott specializes in sourcing organic and fair trade production. Thank you for joining us, Scott.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Can you just give us an update of what the fair trade industry look like today?
I think if we look where it's come from, for so many years, it's been a constant, what we consider to be a moving target around how we can better enhance supply chain, right? So when we look at some of the values that are today around what we do in the Indigenous supply chain, it's about providing a fair wage within a local context, supporting safe and participatory workplaces, supplying financial and technical support, not only financial acumen, but financial literacy to help elevate people within the supply chain, offering community planning and capacity building, ensuring environmental sustainability also is a big part of fair trade, and respecting human rights within cultural identities and the family and community, and maybe most of all, building long-term relationships too, not being a company that goes in for a very short amount of time and tries to get the best price, but ways that we can actually work with a community for a long-term planning and staying with them in that relationship.
So, Scott, what does fair wage within a local context mean exactly?
Yeah, so
can you give us an example of one of your industrial plans?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about fair living wage, we have to look at what it means within what a person, we talk about the bread basket theory. So like what can you put inside literally a basket that helps you sustain yourself for 1 week? And what would be the wage that we can actually compare that to take care of oneself? There's a lot of indexes that are out there of how we measure, for instance, poverty, and how we look at this. There's organizations like the Grameen Foundation that have something that's called the PPI that can help us measure how somebody's actually doing within the context of a wage or doing within the context of their community. So these questions that we can ask, for instance, do you own a refrigerator? Which tells us a lot more than if you own a refrigerator. It tells us that you're thinking about meal planning, that you're thinking about electricity, that you have electricity, and that you're able to purchase large ticket items of that in that way. So these questions that we ask often will tell us where a person sits, and in the middle of that is actually what we can count on as a fair living wage to purchase the items that we need.
Well, let's talk about what workers are currently making right now who are not working for fair trade clothing companies, because I printed out this really great report from the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, and it looks at the women specifically in Bangladesh who make about 80 cents an hour, and these are managers, I should say, and according to the Institute, workers in Sri Lanka who work in the garment worker industry make 32 cents an hour, Bangladesh 33 cents, Vietnam 52 cents. The highest right now is Malaysia, $1.36 an hour.
That's the highest,
$1.36, and these issues are getting a lot more attention because of that horrible building collapse that happened in Bangladesh last year, and we'll talk about that later.
Good.
But, the fact of the matter is wages really matter. So if these people are working for a fair trade company in their countries, what are they making compared to 32 cents an hour or $1.36 at the high level?
You know, there's when we talk about fair trade, there's a different couple different ways to look at it. There's more of the way that, say, the Fair Labeling Organization will look at that, and there's also a different context, maybe the way that Fair Trade USA would go about looking at that. Both of those views around fair trade and the prices that they're paid have to do with having a premium. So we're taking a look at one when we think about factory settings, often they're not even getting those wages. That's a big problem. So even getting people to pay the legal local wages is a huge battle within this garment industry. And we're talking, I mean, I hate to talk about, you know, the truth here around bonded labor. Well, you know, I think that we often won't look at one of the facts is that there's more slavery on the planet right now, currently today, than there ever has been on the planet. And people might think, well, that's, how could that be? But the reality is it's because of the sheer volume of population on the planet. We're talking about bonded labor. We're talking about human trafficking. We're talking about child labor. We're talking about people that don't have a voice. So kind of taking that into context of, there's a lot of people that aren't even making those minimum wages, which clearly are not a whole heck of a lot that you just mentioned. So going back to what you asked, like how do we define fair trade? We're talking about premiums that actually pay more than the local, you know, minimum wage. And those actually can be anywhere between 5, 10, maybe 20% more that go into a kitty, if you will, into a fund that then the workers themselves can decide how to spend that money together in the community as a benefit.
You know, you are a co-founder of Indigenous Designs Corporation. What countries are you working in? Which communities? Yeah. I know you work in Peru and Ecuador, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. And some of the communities you work with, I mean, for centuries, these people have been self-sustaining. Necessarily, they have not been integrated in sort of a free market economy, you know? And then, but their lifestyle has been interrupted by the outsiders, yes, and especially multinational corporations. So when you go enter these communities, what do you see? And then how do you want to change the economic relations and living conditions, not to interrupt their way of life, but sort of be in synergy with it?
I think that's a great question. When we enter the room, you know, how are we disturbing or changing that lifestyle? Literally, when we talk about entering the room, I mean when we're entering into another culture. When we take a trip and we're actually trying to purchase somewhere in another country. So I think it's a very important question to ask. For us, we really want to be in touch with the community in which we work. We see every relationship as, in most cases, we're working with a lot of women too. Mm-hmm. So we see every opportunity that we work with a person as a dream, as an opportunity to access to where do they want to go with their life. So does this person really want to continue to be a laborer that does cut, sew, or knitting, or whatever that is? What's their dream? How can we support that? So we often talk about that in the context of elevating and graduating within our supply chain. We work with a number of 1,500 different, actually, artisans in what we consider to be illegal but informal work setting to support a lot of people that do home work at home, family nucleus structures within primarily Peru. And we'll often see, this is workers maybe between 5 to 15 at a time getting together to aggregate into a small little cooperative. But we'll often see one person that wants to now create something in their neighborhood. And actually, we embrace that, the aspect of that. And we've grown within the context of the last 20 years from a couple hundred independent knitters that are working within this system to now well over 1,500 independent knitters.
In Peru?
In Peru, yes. Wow. Yeah. But we've worked globally as well, everywhere from Armenia to Romania, to India, and even in the Appalachian West Virginia mountains, anywhere we can coalesce a knitting skill and scale it. But primarily over the last decade, we've really focused mostly on Ecuador and Peru. Also because there's a lot of, from a sustainability standpoint, there's a lot of fibers that we can find in that actual region. I'm trying to circle right now in the, as we're talking. But I literally will do that. We draw a circle on the map. We look at how many materials can we find within this this actual system that are natural, one, right, that are not harmful dyes that we're using. So we don't want to introduce any kind of chemicals when we come into a community. So this is a sort of a symbiotic relationship where we're trying to embrace good for people and the planet at the same time. You can't do one and the other.
So you basically buy their fiber.
Yes.
And then they will produce clothing items.
Yeah, so we actually work with organic cotton farmers. So we're not doing, like, we have a commitment to only using 100% certified organic cotton. We don't do any cotton that's not. So that's a certification process where we're working with the farmers in advance, and this is in Peru, right? And then we're bringing that fiber to the actual knitters. But before it gets to the knitters, we have to actually spin it. So we're making sure that when we spin it and dye it, that it's using global organic textile standards, which again is another certification. So we're bringing best-in-class certifications all the way through from an environmental standpoint, but it's very much within a local context of the community in which we're working, within a 100, maybe 150 miles.
Scott Leonard is CEO and co-founder of Indigenous Designs. It's an organic apparel brand and producer of handcrafted fair trade clothing. And I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan at the Green Festival. We'll be on the air for another 45 or so minutes. And Scott, you said you worked with 1,500 artisans, mostly in Ecuador and Peru. What motivated you to go to South America as opposed to setting up shop in the United States where people are hungry for jobs?
Yeah, well, as far as my motivation to make a difference in these women's lives, it started about 20 years ago. And we wanted a vision that we could actually bring an opportunity for these traditional skills to make it to market. That's where we... that originally came up with the idea is that if we could actually control the type of knitting, use some traditional skills, bring in some best quality fibers, we could actually dictate a better price in the market in the U.S. and thus get back a fair living wage and a fair trade wage. As far as doing things in the United States, unfortunately right now there's not enough knitting skills to scale this type of work. But I think that there's a lot of opportunity for us to bring textiles in general back to the United States. And there are a lot of folks that are trying to work towards that. I think you're seeing a lot of spillover in China right now because their middle class is actually rising. And so there's actually a bit more of a competitive advantage to being made here in the United States, not just only from a job standpoint, but literally we can show good value.
It's interesting you say textile. So what has happened to U.S.'s textile industry?
Unfortunately, it got boxed out, priced out little by little, and jobbed out to China.
Outsourced.
Yep. Outsourced,
right?
Completely.
Yep.
And you know, the other thing, some of the countries you named, for example, Armenia, some of these governments are not transparent, they are corrupt, and some of them dictatorship. So it becomes very, very difficult to run a transparent organization like such as yours in a very, very constricted environment. So how do you navigate, sort of negotiate these boundaries?
No, it's a great question, and I'll answer that by telling you one of the things that we actually do right now, and that is that we take it upon ourselves to actually talk and communicate directly with all the people that are in our supply chain. And when I say all the people, that's an initiative that we actually have to contact everybody that's in our supply chain. Out of that 1,500 knitters that I mentioned, we're up to 1,000 knitters now that we've actually been able to ask sets of questions. I mentioned the PPI earlier, which is Grameen Foundation came up with these sets of questions that are indicators as to how people are actually doing within their community and how they're actually doing against what we consider to be the poverty line, right? So we're asking those questions actually through SMS technology and cell phones. And we can do this also because it's an opportunity where a lot of people have cell phones, not necessarily smartphones like a lot of the phones we have in the United States, but they're a bit of the, you know, more basic type of older style cell phones that you can actually receive text messages. And a lot of people that are not in a good financial position actually own these so that they can communicate with their family members and not use them as phones, but only text. So we've taken advantage of that opportunity to communicate and say, do you feel like you work in a safe and participatory workplace? Mm-hmm. Imagine that instead of in Bangladesh.
Wow.
We might not have had that situation at Runa Plaza, right? But I'll go a step further here and tell you what we're doing with some of this information. We're asking these questions. We're actually boiling that down and getting an aggregate. And that shows us how the community is doing, that's actually knitting those items. And then we're posting that up on every single product that we've got. So we've got a barcode that you can scan, and you actually that information will come up on every one of our products, and actually with a Google map of where it's made, who made it, a little bit of information about the culture, so you can really learn and sort of, if you will, imbibe into what you're actually purchasing. And I think that what you're really getting at is transparency. How do we cut through the sometimes government? How do we cut through the middleman, if you will? And how do we actually go to the source to understand how our products, not just apparel, how our products are made?
We've done a lot of shows about sweatshop labor, especially in light of what happened in Bangladesh when 1,100 people were killed in that building collapse. And the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights put out a report because 60,000 workers at the Hameen and Windy Group factories in Bangladesh will now work an 8-hour shift 6 days a week, 48 hours a week. This is a victory. And again, senior managers are making 84 cents an hour. But this is considered a victory. And so when we've done shows about this, I've said, what is the best way we can actually support these women? And some of our guests said, you know, it's great that you're buying fair trade, but that doesn't directly affect the women in Bangladesh still, right? Or the women that are making the Gap or the H&M or Walmart clothes. They're still working in these horrible conditions. So I might feel great wearing an indigenous design sweater,
yep,
and I have one, but what about these women in Bangladesh? They're completely disconnected from this.
Yeah. I want to pause for a second and let us all kind of think about that, because it is... it's a big disconnect. It's a big disconnect. How do we actually help these people in the supply chain? It's not only about Bangladesh, and it's not only about apparel. This is about cell phones. We're here with Green America, right? They ran this campaign with Heather White. It's what's called Bad Apple. And we've actually been able to shift, you know, Apple to and iPhones to work a little bit more towards better environments for people to work. So we asked that question, and you're asking me what's the solution or how can we do something better. I think we can look to organizations like Green America to help us from a consumer standpoint, but it is up to the industries also to get together. And there are people out there, even some of the larger apparel companies, that are starting to come to the table. So for instance, there's organizations like Textile Exchange or the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, which is trying to bring together something called the HIG Index, which is a way for us to report and measure about not only environment but human condition and how we can all put our heads together to actually benchmark better humanitarian, better work environments.
You know, we just had a couple of guests that talked about our food system. And the one of the issues that I can't remember which one brought up is the fact that it's cheap. The processed food, mm-hmm, is cheap. Mm-hmm. So that becomes an appeal for people to use more of it. and not use organic, for example, product. I mean, you can make the same argument about fair trade, because I was looking on your website, beautiful outfits, really, beautiful coats and jackets, $200, $300, $400. And I totally understand this, because you are paying those fair wages and you're transparent, then you have to charge more. But at the same time, that means that this is not going to catch on, and you're not going to have a large base of consumers. So how are you dealing with this issue?
Yeah, first of all, we do have things that are not just $200, $300,
$400. Those are the ones I was interested in.
Yeah, okay. So there's some higher-end items that we have that are like some of our boiled wool alpaca jackets and so forth. But we do have things that actually move down into the $30, $40 price range. They're more like a jersey, thin jersey knit and so forth. But I think you bring up
It was in general.
One could make the case that we are a bit more pricey, but I think that's also because of the position of the brand. Much like, say, like an Eileen Fisher. I mean, we actually produce for Eileen Fisher, their label, but our supply chain. And we tend to have a lot of organic materials, which are a bit more expensive, but we're also creating something that lasts a little bit longer, something that is more sturdy and reliable. And when we look at fast fashion, these things tend to fall apart very quickly, and then they go right into our landfill.
And they're very cheap.
So we like to think of what our brand as sort of like investment shopping. So that's from our standpoint. But as far as how do we tackle that in the marketplace, not sure how we tackle fast fashion.
Well, it's a high cost of cheap, right?
Yeah.
Because you can go to one of these discount stores and get a $5 tank top, but what went into that? Last question, Scott.
Yeah.
With so much awareness about these massive corporations that are treating people so horribly, I mean, I mentioned the wages, 37 cents, 40 cents an hour. And it's a victory when you can only work six days a week, not 7 days a week. Where do you see this going? And guests in the past have said the best thing we can do is to always ask how workers are treated. Because if you don't ask, the corporation's going to assume that you don't care.
I like that. I think that we actually, that's a great thing for anyone that's listening here, is to continue to ask. The consumer plays a huge part in this.
Because the brand is at stake here, right?
That's right.
Walmart doesn't want their label to be found at the bottom of a building collapse in which 1,100 women
died.
That's
right. And we're all accountable for that, too. I think that there's a disconnect where we believe, I didn't buy that. But actually, in a lot of cases, we don't know. So if you continue to ask the questions and actually are diligent in doing that, and you continue on that journey to ask the questions, we're all going to be in a better place. One other thing I would suggest is to look for some of those labels that are environmentally friendly, some of those labels that are fair trade friendly, and maybe even look for companies that are B corporations. That is an assessment that actually is very robust and deep in looking at the entire company. And so you don't get this sort of idea where a company can maybe put together one, like let's say it's a chocolate, very large chocolate company, which I will not mention, that does one tiny fair trade ingredient and then claims to its to consumers that it's fair trade, or it's doing this one fair trade product, or it actually then advertises that one fair trade product, and then consumers get the idea that, oh, this brand is doing a good job. That's not the case. Consumers need to look at a body of work. We need to look at environmental practice as well as fair labor practice, because you cannot decouple planet and people, people and planet. They work together. So B Corp is a good way to do that. B corporations, look for it.
Scott, thank you so much for stopping by. Thank you. Scott Leonard is CEO and co-founder of Indigenous Designs, an organic apparel brand, and producer of handcrafted fair trade clothing. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Rose Aguilar, here with Malihe Razazan at the Green Festival at its new space, Fort Mason, near the marina. It's a beautiful day.
It really is.
Gorgeous day. Actually, if you come here, take a walk by the ocean, but do not drive, because there is no parking, no parking at all. You can take Muni or BART to Civic Center and then get a shuttle to the festival. I highly recommend coming there that way, or take a bus but definitely don't drive because there's no parking. We're going to be here for about another half hour or so. The festival is open until 6 o'clock tonight, and then tomorrow again from 10 o'clock to 6. And our next guest is Karina Bassler. She is the brand new president of the Green Festival. Hi, Karina. Thank you for stopping by.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me here.
So, new building, new president. How did you find yourself in this position?
Well, at Green Festivals, for us, this is not just a job. We are very, very passionate and compassionate about what we're doing. And also from a personal side, I'm a vegan for 10 years and a vegetarian for 20 years.
Yes.
And I love animals and the environment. And I also have a business background, so I thought this would be the perfect combination. And I'm really, really feel honored and happy to be here and to try to make a difference in the world.
So when you start putting these, because they're in different cities,
right,
in the U.S., Washington, Los Angeles, here, and Chicago, is that right?
Yes, correct. We're in New York,
New York,
and in Washington for the spring shows, and then in the fall we were in Los Angeles, in Chicago, and in San Francisco. And next year we will be in Portland.
Okay. So when you start putting these exhibits or this festival together, what is your mission? I mean, what is it that you want to accomplish at the end of the third day?
Well, Green Festival is America's largest and longest running sustainability and green living event. And we believe that everyone can make a difference. Every morning you can choose what to put on your plate. And at Green Festivals, we provide such a perfect market platform for all those consumers who are interested in making a difference in the world. And we have something for everyone. We have green transportation, all those beautiful test drives with Ford and BMW, but also all the great food selections we can offer. We have wonderful food courts, sustainable beer and wine, and we have beautiful body and health creams. We have a yoga pavilion. We at Green Festival believe that we have something to offer for everyone.
How do you determine what companies can participate in the Green Festival? Because I'm looking down, we're kind of on a high rise, and there are four long rows of a variety of small businesses talking to citizens about what they're selling, what they do. How do you determine who gets in here?
Thank you very much for actually asking that question, because we don't want to go into any greenwashing. We want to make sure that we are very strict to our mission and to our policy, actually. Every company who's exhibiting at Green Festivals, they are allowed only to show up with a green offering. So all the products in their booths have to have a green offering and has to be sustainable.
So these companies have to be socially responsible. What does that exactly mean? Because that has been really, I mean,
as you say, greenwash.
And yeah, exactly. So what does that mean?
Well, it really depends from company to company, but they really have to show up with a green offering, which means the products have to be sustainable and they have to be green, and people really must be thrilled to buy them.
And what are your thoughts on the fact that we now have so many labels? Sometimes I buy things with 10 labels. We've been talking today about whether or not there's such a thing as happy meat. We've been talking about GMOs. We've been talking about soil. The average person has to do a lot of homework. It's almost like we always say you need a little mini FDA and EPA in your own home.
That's
just
right.
To keep up with all of this. Because the regulations are so lax, if they exist at all. So it just seems like it's getting more and more complicated.
Yes, yes.
And why does it have to be that way?
Well, that's actually a very, very good question. And hopefully in a couple of years, you know, in every country we can come up with a policy which really fits to all the companies. But as you said, it's very challenging. And At Green Festival, we are partnering with Green America, and Green America has a very strict certification process. And we do encourage our exhibitors to go through Green America's certification process. We don't require it, again, as long as they show up with a green offering, because we also want to grow. We want to invite more companies to participate. And even if a large company is making a difference only by 5% going in the right direction, for the bigger picture, it makes a huge difference.
So in some ways, not only you exhibit small companies and, you know, the small businesses, but it seems like you are actively engaged with big corporations.
Yes.
So what has been that relationship like?
For example, Ford is one of our long-standing partners and our gold sponsor, and we're very honored and thrilled to have Ford joining Green Festivals. And they're here with their wonderful green car fleet, with their all-electric and hybrid cars. And Ford, of course, only also produces other cars, but this is such a great platform here where they can show their attendees that they're helping and making a difference. And we also want to make sure at Green Festival that you can test, that you can sample, that you can showcase, that it's not just theoretical, that you can also see, you know what, it's also about having fun, because we don't want to have we don't want to tell people what to do and how to live their life. They basically have to feel it from inside and have to see that this is also a fun component to live healthy and to live a green life.
You know, one of the major issues that we have talked about many years on the program and here at the Green Festival is the fact that green movement in general has suffered from lack of diversity. And that's something that has to be actively addressed by
Absolutely.
People in the environmental movement and green movement. So I was wondering, that's why in the beginning I asked you about the mission of Green Festival. How actively are you looking at that in attracting people of color, communities of color, and people who really do not get that much attention in the movement itself?
Right. At Green Festivals, we believe that we want to embrace everyone. We welcome every color, every nationality. It actually doesn't matter where you come from. As long as you're interested and come with an open mind and see what Green Festivals has to offer. And I really appreciate that you're asking about diversity, because it's not just about also about food, about transportation. We want to embrace all the different categories, because all the categories have to move and have to bring a green offering to make a difference.
We were talking earlier about the small businesses versus the big businesses, and it got me thinking about these multinationals that are buying up organic companies now. And this was really exposed during the debate over GMO labeling here in California, where the multinationals spent $42 million against labeling. And we started learning about the fact that Coca-Cola owns Odwalla, Clorox owns Burt's Bees, General Mills just bought Annie's. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. What are your thoughts on that? Because now these small companies that used to be, for example, for labeling, now are owned by these massive corporations that are against labeling. And a lot of people say that the product eventually does change. It just takes a little time.
Right.
Yeah, because you see the ingredient change. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, personally, I would like to appreciate that the policies are much more stricter. For example, that you force companies to put this, to label it, and to put this on every package, and to be more transparent and more honest to the consumers. And then the consumer basically can make the decision. But you're absolutely right. It's much more complicated. And, of course, with Green Festivals, we are very strict. We are vegan, vegetarian. We promote non-GMO products. And that's very important that we do stick to our mission.
You know, since you have this festival in major cities around the country, do you see a difference in both food culture in terms of environmental consciousness, the way people approach or react to this festival? And you know, what has been your experience, Nice? Because, you know, I sometimes feel in San Francisco, we kind of live in a bubble. In the Bay Area, I have to
right.
say. We live in sort of a very correct bubble, in terms of food culture.
That's a very good question. Especially here in San Francisco, I have noticed that people are already very, very aware and very conscious. And they already know, basically. You know, you don't have to explain something. You don't really have to start. But, you know, there are other cities, for example, New York, where that's a market which still can grow. There are a lot of companies where we feel that with the help of Green Festivals, we can really make a difference. And also all of our great speakers, they're so wonderful to help us to educate also the people and to address so many diverse topics and to bring them in. And then step by step, you know, it's some only come for example, for a program element, and then they have the chance to go to the food court and, you know, just to try and to experience all those different exhibitors. And then they see, oh my God, you know, it's green and it's also tasty. And this is a wonderful way to help, for example, people in New York to bring the green element closer into their own life. But here in San
Francisco, last year I went to New York during winter time, mm-hmm. and I realized that they had these really very small farmers market, very small, but most of their food, fresh vegetables, I mean, some oranges and apple, I mean, they were very expensive. But most of their fresh vegetables, it was brought in packaged from California. So they have a different relationship with the food system as, you know, in contrast to what we have here.
Absolutely. And especially in San Francisco, you're also very aware of social justice issues and about trying to produce local, which is also very important, and helping the communities. At the Green Festivals, we believe it's not just all about business. Contrary, we want to give back to the small businesses and also to the community. And that's why on Sunday at 3:30 at the Green Festival stage, we're announcing our Green Festival Brand Award and Community Award winner. We have five finalists, five local San Francisco-based nonprofit organizations, and all of our attendees here, they have the chance to vote for their favorite local community. For example, the Milo Foundation, it's a nonprofit, it's a shelter. So come to Green Festivals, come with an open heart, and you meet so many people, so many connections, and you make more friends than you could have ever imagined. And then you also have the chance here to adopt a pet, to adopt a cat, and
Adopt a cat?
Yes, we have.
Really?
We introduced the Green Festival Saves Life campaign, and we do partner with the Milo Foundation, and actually my team, they told me, like, Karina, you cannot go there again because I already have four cats at home, so...
How many cats need adopting here?
They have a couple of cats, and they have a lot of puppies. They have a lot of dogs too. I mean, it's just wonderful. It's very heartwarming.
That's great.
Karina Bassler is the new president of the Green Festival, and I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan. We are at the Green Festival. We'll be here for about another 20 minutes or so. It's at its new location, the Fort Mason Center in San Francisco on the Marina Green. I keep saying this, but it's because I don't want you to be stressed out today. Do not drive. You can take public transportation and then get yourself to Civic Center BART and jump on the shuttle. That's the best way to get here, and then leave some time to walk along the Marina Green because it's so beautiful. Karina, you recently wrote a story for climatechangeadvocacy.com called "New Study Shows Major Environmental Impact on Meat Consumption." You write that Americans are eating more meat than almost anyone else in the world. However, meat has a more damaging impact on the environment than any other food we consume. And since its inception, the Green Fest has always been vegetarian and vegan. Talk about the decision-making process behind that.
As mentioned in my little study, producing meat is one of the most destructive ways, basically, for the planet. You need, for 1 pound of beef, you need hundreds of gallons of water to produce that one little piece And we believe there are so many other ways to basically get calories in your body. And also, it's not just about resources, it's also about compassion. Those creatures are all alive, and they feel the pain like you and I do. And we believe that everything is connected on this planet, and we cannot just ignore them. And once again, there are so many great alternatives. Come to the Green Festival, check it out, all those different companies and all those different products.
And I also want to mention this really very interesting research that was mentioned in the Time magazine, which is using about 50 years worth of data from the world's 100 most populous countries. It's a study by University of Minnesota, and it shows that actually plant-based diet and Mediterranean diet, not based on a fad, based on
50 years
of worth of data, that it's just not about the consumption of these fast food products or, you know, just meat, or it's that the ripple effect it has on the environment, on our health. So it's very interesting, this research that also confirms some of the issues that you're bringing up.
Absolutely. Actually, that topic I do take straight to my heart. And yes, actually, we at Green Festival, we would love to educate the people and to really share the message that eating meat, it's really not sustainable. It's not. And there are so many great plant-based options out there to make a difference.
What are your thoughts on just the awareness that has been raised around this specific issue? So many more documentaries. People are speaking openly about it. The New York Times is running a vegetarian Thanksgiving feature. Chris Hedges, the radical writer, recently announced that he decided to go vegan. He and his wife said that this is the best thing they can do for the environment.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
It just happened last week. It just seems that so much is happening around this particular issue. What do you see going forward?
Well, I do believe that this is definitely the right step moving forward, because this is a one-way street. There is no way that we can go back. Whatever is destroyed on the planet is destroyed. So people are realizing this is something they have to take responsibility for. And I do deeply believe in individual responsibility. What I mean is every day you personally can make a decision what to put on your plate. And also feel good about it. You know, feel good about it that you help the future generations, your children, your grandchildren, just to make sure that the planet goes on.
And just quickly, what do you say to people who think this kind of diet is really out of touch for a lot of people? It's not affordable, and it's just not. A lot of people can't follow this kind of diet.
Yes, I'm actually, as I mentioned, I'm also a vegan, so I know all those comments. Well, I would love to see that people are open for it, that people at least try it, that people, you know, test it and at least sample it. And if they don't like it, of course, we don't want to force people what to put on the plate. But once again, all those resources which is needed to produce just 1 pound of beef, it's not sustainable. And also, everyone has feelings, and we're all very compassionate here. And that goes for the entire Green Festival staff, and that's just wonderful. And I'm personally very thrilled and blessed to be here.
Thank you so much, and really, thank you for helping us find parking.
Thank you, Karina.
You made this show happen.
Karina Bassler is the brand new president of the Green Festival. Thank you for stopping by, Karina. I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan at the Green Festival, and it happens today until 6 o'clock, tomorrow from 10 to 6 at the Fort Mason Center. And I encourage you not to drive because there's no parking. Try to get to Civic Center BART, and then from there a shuttle will pick you up. And now I would like to welcome Molly McCobb to the show. Molly is regional manager with the Rising Sun Energy Center. And the Rising Sun Energy Center addresses two very pressing issues. And that is, they work with youth and adults to find green jobs and then also reducing community energy and resource consumption. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah.
So it's so interesting because gosh, green jobs was getting so much attention about 5 years ago. I don't really hear people talk about green jobs like they did back then. Why is that?
I think the movement was very popular during that time, and then a lot of folks kind of lost interest, or a lot of the funding went away. And so what's really unique about our program is that we have a sustainable funding structure that really allows us to keep operating and expanding. We work in partnership with PG&E, our youth program does anyways, and helping them reduce their or meet their energy saving goals. So we employ young people throughout 20 cities in the Bay Area during the summertime for a 6-week duration of time. And they go into residents' homes and install free energy and water measures, such as LED and CFL light bulbs, low-flow shower heads, kitchen and bathroom sink aerators, as well as they provide education to clients on how to further reduce their water and energy consumption. We do other pilot programs like solar assessments, as well as electronic waste pickup and removal. And we've been operating since 2000, so this is 2014, and we've just expanded into Solano and Stanislaus County. So it's an industry where you have to have a niche where you're going to be sustainable and be able to continue to grow as well.
So you have trained and employed 1,760 individuals. 68% of the participants live in poverty or are low income. How do you find these people?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So our youth program, we do a lot of outreach through local schools within the cities that we're working in. We try to hire and train local youth. So we outreach and recruit through schools, community organizations. And then for our adult program, we have a lot of partnerships with social service agencies that are helping formerly incarcerated adults or adults who are unemployed find gainful employment. So we build a lot of partnerships within the community that already exists so that they know about us as a resource that they can then give us referrals for.
When you first make contact with some of these young people, especially young people who get out of prison, mm-hmm. what do you find really excites them about this program? I mean, what gets them saying, yeah, I really want to get involved with that? Because, you know, as you know, for a lot of people who get out of prison, I mean, it's so hard for people to find a job. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the resources they have aren't that exciting. Like, they don't want to really get up in the morning and feel like, yes, I made a difference, which we all want, right? So what really excites them about doing this kind of work?
I think it's two things primarily. It's they're having gainful employment within one of the fastest growing industries. So in their minds, they're thinking, wow, this is a job that is really going to be sustainable for me now and into the future. As well as the 6-week training program that we have for adults is really hands-on, tactful skills that they can use in a variety of jobs. So whether that's installing solar panels or doing a home energy audit or water conservation methods, they really learn tangible hands-on skills that are really going to benefit them.
So where do they go from there when they finish the apprenticeship program with you in your organization?
Well, we have a case manager on staff who works with them, finding them a job with our local partnerships with union workers, union organizations, as well as green construction companies and solar companies. So we really build partnerships. In addition to the recruitment, we build partnerships with local businesses that are going to be looking to hire our participants once the training program ends.
And also, you said that you have partnered with PG&E.
Mm-hmm.
Since this is such a unique program, there are not very many like it. How much support are you getting on the city and the state level and also on the federal level for this kind of job creating programs?
Mm-hmm. Well, we also apply for federally funded grants. And then within each of the 20 cities that we're located, there is not only does PG&E support us, but also the cities do provide some funding to have the program operate in their city, as well as local water agencies. So the water agencies supply us with all of the in-kind donations, such as the low-flow shower heads and the kitchen and bathroom aerator, so that can then be free to the residents. And then the cities provide us with funding and office space and computers and outreach methods that we can that help support our program, as well as additional funding.
We're speaking with Molly McCobb. She's regional manager with Rising Sun Energy Center, and they have trained and employed 1,760 individuals. 68% of the program's Program participants live in poverty or are low income. Over 1,000 young people have been trained. 27,000 households have been served. Are these young people who come from low-income areas able to also do the work like the shower heads and all of this in their own homes?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Oh, that's great.
That's one of the things that they feel most excited about is taking this information back home to their family and their extended families and community as well.
And so when they get this knowledge, I mean, what is the process involved in terms of the training process? How long does it take? Mm-hmm. How long will they stay with you? And then can you give us maybe an example of two people who really stand out for you?
Yes.
Or one.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have a week of training before the energy specialists, is what we call them, before they start going out into the field and providing the home energy and water audits. So that's kind of the extensive training that they get around how to do the home energy and water assessments, as well as further training on clean energy and energy alternative solutions. So that's the training that they receive, and then on-the-job training, of course, happens throughout the duration of the program. That's 6 weeks long, and then we have students who then go on. Just last month, we were on a staff retreat, and a woman came up to our executive director, Jody Pincus, and said, "Oh, my daughter used to work with your program. She was an energy specialist. She now goes to school and is in environmental education." So it really influences young people's career path in so many different ways. Some people then want to go on and work for PG&E or work for the water district. So it really depends on what they're already interested in, and then this kind of sparks further interest in them.
You know, the other thing that we did a segment on our news earlier this year, mm-hmm. about your program, and featured a couple of the kids. And something that's really interesting struck me was that it's not just about Green Job. It's about the fact that these kids were so difficult going into strangers' homes. Mm-hmm. And then eventually they started talking to them. They became comfortable with them. So it's also a confidence-building a process as well for these young students.
Yeah, and it's a very empowering experience for them as well, because they're young people who are educating adults on energy efficiency and water education, which isn't something that readily happens in communities. So it kind of changes the focus on who has the knowledge here and who's disseminating that information.
Where is this going at a time when we're seeing strapped budgets? I mean, I'm sure that a place like San Francisco and other cities in the Bay Area,
Oakland,
Berkeley, Marin, are grasping onto these kinds of programs. But where do you see it going from here?
Well, I see it just continuing to expand. So because now we started working in 2000, we were in like 7 different cities, and now we're in 20 cities. So I see it just expanding and expanding throughout California.
It must be rewarding work for you.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We should bring some of these kids on the show.
Yeah, we'd love to have some of these kids on the show.
Oh, they would love to talk about it.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Molly. Thanks for your work, and thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you.
Molly McCobb is regional manager with the Rising Sun Energy Center. They have trained and employed 1,760 individuals. 68% of program participants live in poverty or are low income. This is such a great project. Well, 2 hours has gone by. That's it. We're out of time. I'm Rose Aguilar.
And I'm Malihir Azazan. Thank you so much for joining us for this special broadcast of KLW live from the Green Festival. We have volunteers waiting for you at our booth in spot 634. Stop by and say hello. And if you would like to receive our newsletter, please do leave us your contact information and email address.
This show was produced by Laura Flynn. Phil Hartman engineered the show on site. Joanne Marr is engineering at the station. Thank you all. And thanks to the Green Festival associates, Suzanne Hagman, Amanda Wellborn, Brian Chayon, and David Lieberson. And thank you so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And now we will send it back to Joanne Marr in the KALW studios.
Thank you.
Saturdays at 5, it's a patchwork quilt, playing music of Celtic and other traditions, American roots music, singers and songwriters, instrumentalists and interpreters, songs of sentiment and silliness, of things topical and timeless. We'll meet new friends and visit old ones. I'm Kevin Vance. Join me for a patchwork quilt, Saturdays at 5, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org.
Hi, Hi, I'm Peter Thompson, inviting you to join me every Saturday night at 6:30 for Bluegrass Signal. 90 minutes of music from the True Vine, usually presented around a theme, and including the area's most comprehensive calendar of events, often with musical previews. That's Bluegrass Signal, Saturday at 6:30, right here on KALW San Francisco.
In the dry cool of her steel and glass rental, with a full-time cook and gardener, she felt like one of those infinitely pampered child pharaohs, like King Tut's sister or something, awaiting interment in the Valley of the Kings.
I'm Cynthia Nixon. Join me this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tomorrow afternoon at 5, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
The first night I moved into her newly painted bedroom, there was a huge fire in the fireplace, and I had to get people to come in and put out the fire, and one of them told me that they saw a mummy in the smoke.
Tune in for more true stories told live next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
The Moth Radio Hour, tomorrow evening at 6, here on KALW San Francisco. There'd be no KALW without our listener supporters, people like Ian and Lynn Jefferson from San Francisco. Thank you for your contributions of financial